Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
En Camino with Kit Hogg.
Morning and a warmer welcome than ever this Saturday, the 15th of August. Yes, you're En Camino with me, Kit Hogg, on the programme today. A postcard from Barcelona on the part of the show we call Things That Grow, the Fat Cats of Southwest London, where, would you believe, feline obesity is becoming a problem in these days of accumulated heat saturation. Isn't there something like the awakening of team spirit in the greeting? Como va el verano? To which the answer in the campo anyway is harto de verano, yeah. Which means I'm fed up with the summer. Like we're all in it, all holding onto the kitchen table together. A little later I'll be paying tribute to that sentiment and asking, is it plain wishful thinking? Is it delusional to entertain the idea that summer is almost over? Yes, probably it is. So in that likelihood, we take a peek at the hot new fashion that's sweeping Japan, that's not hot at all. Say hello to air-conditioned clothes. And delighted to welcome TRE's resident historian, the mellifluously talented and endlessly engaged Giles Brown, with the second and possibly concluding instalment of the heroic and ancient enigma known as Hannibal.
En Camino with Kit Hogg.
Giles, greetings and good day.
Hail Caesar.
Listen, now, before we mention the word elephant, oops, I just did, but because everyone who's heard of Hannibal the Carthaginian, as opposed to Hannibal Lecter, quite rightly associates him with elephants.
Yes.
But it's pertinent to point out that before there was any trumpeting, Hannibal had a lesser known but probably more enduring connection with Spain.
Absolutely. I mean, Hannibal and Spain is founded on what the Carthaginians kind of did next, as the saying goes. So let me just put into context, update, because it was one of my roving history things last day. But basically, Carthage, which is founded by legend by Dido, who escapes from Tyre. Okay, that's your ancient history. Okay, Carthage is now modern Tunis on that thing, opposite Sicily. So it gives you that leap over to Sicily. And then onto Rome itself, okay, onto Italy itself. Okay, at the end of the First Punic War, which is basically Carthage against Rome, and you're thinking Carthage of the great naval power, Rome of the great land power. So it is the elephant and the whale. The machinations of the war is that Carthage always fights with mercenaries. To be Carthaginian means that they haven't got an awful lot of land to play with, and they tend to hire mercenaries. And what basically happens at the end of the first Punic War, they have a mercenary revolt because they can't pay the forces who've been fighting because they'd be defeated by the Romans, which means that a very well-known general called Hamilcar, who is Hannibal's dad, manages to horrendously subdue the mercenaries' revolt. He becomes a top dog in military circles, but there's a bit of infighting. So to get out of the machinations of politics in Carthage, he decides to go over with his own basically private army and have a look at Spain, because he realizes that Spain is going to be a rich place for him. And he takes his kids with him, because you do, it's take your kid to work day. And he takes his three sons, who are Hasdrubal and also Mago, but the most important one to them all is Hannibal. And they all go off on a...
And he's only 9 years old.
He's 9 years old. Yeah. And here's the thing. He you know, Hamilcar makes Hannibal famously swear an oath that he will never submit to the Romans. He will never. Now, so basically, Hamilcar has done, he's sussed it, because I went to this whole thing about the Phoenicians, and they're all related because Carthaginians are related from Phoenicians. Phoenicians are, if you like, the Aussie tourists of the Mediterranean ancient world. They set up, they're not colonies, they're little ports around the place. So they are in Marseille, they are in Syracuse, they are in Gadis, which is of course is Cadiz. Mm-hmm. And so they've all set up these little, they're
actually traders, aren't they?
They're traders. Yeah. They are brilliant seafarers. Mm-hmm. You know, they are the guys who go through the end of the world, as we know, Gibraltar and Ceuta, basically, nothing changes there. But what I'm saying is that is the, and but they go through that, you know, and there's a guy called Mago who we don't talk about this time, but he is the guy who sails round the African coast.
Oh, right. He goes out of the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
Scary.
Scary stuff indeed. So basically, so Hamilcar, who is Hannibal's dad, goes to realizes that there is silver in them there hills, right?
So in Spain. Okay, so he's arrived in Spain with his three sons and his private army to escape the machinations of Carthage.
Carthage, yeah,
right.
Because okay. he knows he's in trouble if he stays in Carthage, because they've got no cash. Because they've signed this. The Carthage has signed the Treaty of Versailles, basically, with Rome. I.e., you can't do this, and you can't do that, and you can't do the other. And so he knows that he's gonna be in trouble with the, because he's being so successful. The Carthaginian nobility or the Carthaginian rulers are a bit suspect, because the Romans don't want a decent general hanging around Carthage.
Right. Now you mentioned the word Rome.
Yes.
And he's got a thing about Rome, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Because he makes the young Hannibal swear at a very in front of an altar or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
forever that he will hate Rome.
Absolutely,
forever wage war with Rome.
And the Romans like this because it means that when they write their history about Carthage and Hannibal, Hannibal can be seen as the ultimate anti-hero, because here this is this kid who's swearing at an altar with his dad that he will always hate the Romans. By the way, it's not just the Romans and the Carthaginians in this story, because the Greeks are around, the Macedonians. So this is only, remember, 60 years since Alexander the Great. So there are Hellenic ports as well. So rather than colonies, you've got people don't go inland at this point, not really, right? Mm. So it's, think of it, you know, and don't think of it as Southern Europe, because it's Southern Europe and the North, and it's the Levant and it's the North African
right,
coast.
Right, the rim of the Mediterranean,
exactly,
effectively.
Exactly. So that's the situation. Just quickly, so Hamilcar lands, he takes over most of the ports, and he founds this new place called Carte Hadash. Yeah, in Carthaginian, okay? Mm-hmm. Carte Hadash, which becomes New Carthage, which will in time become Cartagena.
Cartagena, okay, right. Down there near in Murcia.
Correctly, and that gives him a huge hit immediately to the silver mines, because they are brimming with silver mines, yeah, that area, brimming with silver, and that means that he can pay mercenaries.
Okay.
Right.
So he gets his army,
yep.
But what's on the horizon, what looms on the horizon is the displeasure of Rome. How does he incur that?
Right, so basically what happens, I mean, long story short, so Hamilcar comes over, he's subduing various tribes, because obviously you've got Celt-Iberian tribes or whatever. Hamilcar gets killed, he's out of the picture, right?
The dad,
very famously, in a battle, it all goes wrong, they're doing a retreat, he does the rear guard to make sure that his sons get away, and he is heroically slain in the best ways of, you know, every Disney movie, saving the three sons, okay? That then means that ruling Iberia then passes, or ruling the Carthaginians then passes to Hasdrubal the Handsome, right? Who is Hannibal's brother-in-law, okay?
Right.
And Hasdrubal the Handsome is a really good diplomat, yeah? He expands New Carthage. He's a very clever guy. He marries, as I said before, he's married to Hannibal's sister, but he makes sure that he signs a lot of treaties with the tribes, the Celtic tribes.
Right.
The Iberian
okay,
Celtic tribes.
Iberians,
yeah, right?
Yeah.
And that attracts lots of specialists forces. So I'll talk about the Carthaginian army in a minute, but it's important to note that this, the Celtic tribes, the Ibero-Celts, think, oh, we can get paid. We're fighting, you know, they're fighters, they're proper fighters. And they're like, well, rather than bashing the hell out of my neighbour, why don't I come and fight for Hasdrubal the Handsome, and therefore I can make a, you know, make a decent living.
Because presumably there's money around. Oh, if they're making money from trading.
They're mining silver. I mean, they're mining huge amounts of silver. Right. So Cartagena, New Carthage, is basically this wonderful port. Trading's going on. It's, you know, if you've been to Cartagena, you know what a great bay is.
I haven't actually been there.
Right.
No.
So therefore, anyway, it's a natural port. So all's going well. Everything is fine. Hannibal is helping his brother-in-law. He's 20, 23, 24. He's already proved himself as a dashing commander in the Iberian forces. Everything's going fine. And then Hasdrubal the Handsome gets assassinated, which, you know, it's not in fighting. It's just, you know, one of those daggers from an upset chieftain sort of situation. So Hannibal is now in power, and that changes everything, right?
Okay. So let's get on to what he's best known for. I mean, he presumably incurs the wrath of the Romans. There's a quarrel over a place called Sargento or something.
Here's the thing. Okay, so they have it's really interesting because don't think of it's spheres of influence. It's not territory, okay? But the Romans and the Carthaginians decide that they will have a demarcation zone, all right? So basically, anything south of the Ebro, the big river, mm-hmm. yeah, and we're talking untamed rivers here. We're not talking because they don't manage. Mm-hmm. Anything south of the Ebro, Carthage can take care of. Although Carthage is still dealing with, you know, Hannibal's still dealing with, you know, various troops, various tribes who aren't in the game, right? They tend to be in interior, up north, the Basques, as always, etc. Anything north of the Ebro, Roman influence. There are still Greek cities, though, there. There are still Hellenic cities. Yeah?
Okay,
yeah.
So it's not clear. It's not super demarcated.
No.
But they have split. He's got an agreement with the Romans.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. However,
there's a partition.
There's a place called Saguntum, right? In which is still there, and that's south of the Ebro. So officially, it's in Carthaginian sphere of influence. However, they have Roman sympathies, if you like. They quite like the Romans. And basically, what happens is there is a massacre of Carthaginian supporters by the people of Saguntum. Yeah, Hannibal lays siege to it. And they're quite good at siege. But this, Saguntum is... The siege goes on for 8 months, right? And Hannibal will not want to lay siege to anywhere else. It has a big impact on him. That comes in... This may explain why he doesn't go for Rome at the end of the whole situation.
Okay? Yes.
Right? It's extremely bloody siege. They take Saguntum. Saguntum gets absolutely pulverized. And that sparks the Second Punic War. The Romans go, right, well, that is enough for us, because they want to get Carthage off the map. They've been fighting them all over the place. They've been fighting them in the Sicily, they'd be fighting him everywhere. So that sparks the second Punic War, and that's your elephants in the whole situation.
Okay. So my question at this point,
yes.
is why doesn't... So Hannibal's going after Italy,
yes.
going after Rome.
Yes.
And it's important to remember at this point that not all of Italy is Roman.
Correcto.
Good. Why doesn't he just get in his boats and sail over there? Because they are the big naval power.
Because at the end of the First Punic War, there has been a big shift, and they have had their military naval power. It's been curtailed. Not only that, though, we're not talking master and commander, big sailboats. We're talking oars, my man. We are talking galley slaves, right? So the situation here is that you, because you've got galley, i.e., you know, think Ben Hur and all
people
that.
People rowing.
Yeah, you
like the Norwegians at the World Cup.
Yeah, like the Norwegians at the World Cup, but unfortunately, not as much fun if you are down there. You don't. You know what? I think I'll become a galley rower. So basically, you only have a. If you want to get going on a galley, yeah, you need loads of people, okay? If you have loads of people rowing, they are going to go through an awful lot of, and here comes your Norwegian, an awful lot of carbs during a day, right? They need water because it's the Med, and they need feeding, right? That takes up space, as do people sitting down rowing, yeah? And, I mean, I know it's not exactly...
And are they any good for fighting at the end of it?
Absolutely not.
Probably not.
No.
They're exhausted.
All right.
Okay.
So you can't put elephants in a thing stuffed full of galleys, and you can't put horses in there. Hannibal's got the biggest... It's got 4,000 cavalry minimum, right? That's a lot. So they cannot go, and your range is basically 3 to 4 days in a galley, before you've got to port somewhere. Yep. You cannot leap from Cartagena. And Hannibal kicks off in Cadiz to begin with, in Galicia, you know. Right. And then he thinks, right, I'm going to do things my way or the highway. I'm going to go north.
Right. And so, all right. So he decides to go overland. Yep. Now.
Yes.
That's an elephant.
I just saw the bus shore.
Where do the elephants come from? I mean, this is bizarre, right, isn't it? Why take elephants? From? He's got the best cavalry in the ancient world. Why does he take elephants?
Because if I am a Roman, perish the thought, I don't like the Romans, but if you are standing there, you know, with your square shield and your javelin, and suddenly, you know, and suddenly Dumbo appears on the horizon, and you've never seen an elephant before, because remember, this is not Discovery Channel. You can't go on your smartphone. You get this thunderous beastie. Put it this way, Hannibal uses elephants against a combined Ibero-Celt force of 100,000, yeah? And he gets them to charge them across a river, never a good move. And then he goes, look, elephants, off you go, Dumbo. And they come caraging down the, you know, trumpeting down the, with a trumpety trumpety trump, they go into the water, because elephants like a bit of water, and they absolutely stomp, like literally 100,000 Celt Iberians.
Right, the elephants are now proving themselves, yes, so against the Celtic
Iberians. Right, so originally he gets these are North African elephants, yeah, who are found in the, I think it's the rhododendron. Anyway, there are forests of rhododendron or something.
Not rhododendron.
Okay, well, anyway.
Rhododendrons are native
they
of Nepal.
Come, okay, well, they come.
I'm a tree man.
I know. So anyway, but there are forests of the Atlas Mountains. In the foothills of the Atlas Mountains, there is a now extinct North African elephant. And they're not as big as the African elephants, more akin to the Indian elephants. They're about 2 meters tall, right? But they still need training and capturing the whole thing. But they are, the Carthaginians spent ages in training these, and they have mahouts. So the original ones are from North Africa.
Yes.
From North Africa. Then he will bring from Indian, you know, he will bring Indian elephants via Egypt and all that way through Carthage in the end with mahouts, etc. And those
he had his own personal elephant, didn't he? Which was an Indian elephant. I love that.
Yeah, no, you see, this is the thing. So when he goes north, when he reaches, leap forward, all the talk of elephants, there is actually only one elephant who makes it to Italy in the end. Hannibal doesn't rock up with 37 elephants in Rome and go, come on, you know, have you met Jumbo? Because
original complement of elephants, there were only 37.
37. That's really enough.
Yeah.
Trust me.
It's not a lot of elephants, is it?
But elephants can do a lot of damage. You know, an elephant will do an awful lot of damage if it's handled correctly. Trust me on this one.
Okay.
So, yes. All right. So, Hannibal goes north, right? He's picking up troops as he's going. He's got the silver, okay? He leaves Hasdrubal, not the handsome, his brother, in charge there. Mago, his other brother, heads off to the Balearics, right? The composition of the army, when he leaves, he's got about 90,000 troops, including 4,000 Numidian horsemen, i.e. Libyans, yeah? Fearsome cavalry they are. He's got his own Carthaginian heavy cavalry, not to be trifled with, okay? He's got heavy infantry, he's got javelin, he's got Celto-Iberian javelin throwers, he's got Celto-Iberian infantry, i.e. the stabby sword people. He's got skirmishers, and I love this lot because these are the Iberian slingers. The Iberian slingers are catapult experts from Ibiza and Mallorca that Mayo sends over, right? He's got a mixed bag. He's got the Celts coming on board because his trick is to, as he goes, it's my enemy's enemy is like, okay, well, we're going to get paid.
Yeah.
We can have a crack at the Romans. Yep. Yeah. But also on the way, can you sort my dispute with my cousin?
So he picks up some Gauls on the way.
But he's very clever because he lets some people go if he reckons they're going to be problems, because he leaves, he sends 10,000 of his troops back to hang out with his bro to keep Iberia, because it's not they're not walking through fields happily back in Iberia. He's still fighting, Hasdrubal's still fighting Celts left, right and centre, just to keep it quiet. And some, he picks up some on the way, but there are others, like he has to skirt Marseille, because that's obviously Greek territory. He has to try and cross the Rhone. Now, this is a huge undertaking, and they've got a force of unhappy Celts on the other end, of Gauls on the other end. Anyway, long story short.
No, Chelsea, don't rush. Okay. Don't rush. I think where we're going to leave it today.
Are we?
Is where we're going to leave it today.
Where, okay.
Let's talk about crossing the Rhone.
Yes.
Tranquilo.
Yes.
And then what we'll do is we'll leave them on the edge crossing the Alps.
Okay.
So nobody knows whether they're going to get there or
Can
not.
Can I just say then? Okay. So please, yeah. Basically, if I'm imagine the situation. I am Gilles the Gallic chieftain. Okay. I have my finest warriors behind me, and hither comes Hannibal. Now, I've never heard of the Carthaginians. I've certainly never heard of an elephant, right? So all I know is I'm sitting there, you know, with my vin, my borsa, my pan.
Drinking your meat.
Drinking my meat. No, is this a Provence? I'm having a fine red.
Du vin.
Yeah, du vin, de borsa, de pain, yeah, oui. You know, and I'm sitting there with my little Juliette, you know, with my little, anyway. And basically, my sketch is saying, smoking a Gadois, you know, a Gadwick Gadois, you know. And suddenly I get reports that there's a bunch of, like, strange looking, because the Carthaginians like to wear long trousers. I love this about the Carthaginians. They wear long trousers. None of this showing your knees off like the hell, you know, like the Romans.
Like
do.
The Romans.
Yeah, exactly.
The Romans wore skirts, didn't they?
The Romans wore skirts, and as for the Greeks, let's not even go there. So,
yeah, right.
So I'm so
leather ones.
I have no idea who these guys are, what their intentions are, because he's not got a sign saying just passing through to go and, you know, go and biff up the Romans.
Sure.
So my plan of defence is to get me and my tribes mates to stand on the banks of the Rhone and go, go away.
You know,
your mother smelt of elderberries and your father was a hamster, you know, in ancient Gaelic, right? And basically make a lot of noise and blow your trumpets, right? So Hannibal, clever boy. So here, and the Rhone is a massive river. It's a massive barrier.
Absolutely.
Okay. So what he does is he quietly sends his Numidians, who are the best cavalry, no stirrups, you know, no reins, yeah, javelins.
No reins, wow.
Yeah, these are good guys. But they will turn, in the end, spoiler alert. Anyway, we'll get into that. So he sends them on a recce. Yeah, he sends them about 20 miles up river to find a place they can ford. And so basically what then happens is he overnight sends his Numidians and a detachment of heavy infantry, and they creep all the way along overnight, and they creep very, very quietly up behind the Gauls for the next morning. And the Gauls can't tell that they have been making, because they've been making too much noise, going, your mother was a hamster and your father smelt of elderberries, or vice versa.
Wait on, how did they cross the river, though, Josh?
They went and forded it 30 miles upland.
Ah, so
they found a point.
It was thinner. It was narrower.
It was narrower, it was shallower.
Right.
And they hadn't, of course, the Gauls hadn't thought about that, because they're not military geniuses like Hannibal.
Right.
Their thing is to, you know, basically be away fans, or, you know, think Perpignan away, basically.
So they muller the Gauls, or do they take them with them?
They muller the Gauls. The Gauls just break off and go, oh, sacre bleu.
Yeah.
Right. Papa, Nicole. And, you know.
Qu'est-ce que c'est?
Gas, quel fromage. And zut alors. And they get out of Dodge. And that leaves pretty much the path, which is the path that has been tread by Hercules before in antiquity, all the way to Rome. And that's when he pulls up to the edge of Rome with his the edge of the Alps with his and there are two options, and we'll come to that when we continue this journey, shall we?
Yeah, Josie, I think we're going to have to leave it there, but that's absolutely fascinating. So we're going to leave Hannibal and his 37 elephants,
yeah,
and his army of around 40,000
plus, yeah, plus the,
it's a polygot army,
yeah. Don't forget the Iberian slingers
and the Numidian horsemen
and they're
looking at the Alps thinking, how do we get across them?
Indeed.
Yeah, lovely, lovely, mate. Thank you so
much.
And
he's not packed his extra large snowshoes for the elephants.
We will. Do we know what time of year this is as well?
Yeah, October.
Ooh, right, okay, so winter's closing in.
Winter is coming, Kit. Winter is coming.
The peaks are shrouded in mists, and, yeah. Okay, well, hasta la próxima, Giles.
Indeed. Just make sure you pack the vinegar. All will be revealed next time round.
En Camino with Kit Hogg.
It's said that of Spanish life in the campo, that you go to bed early because there's nothing to do, and then you get up early because there's so much to do. High summer puts a different slant on this regime. Sure, you do get up at still dark, stupid o'clock, because the dawn watering of your tomatoes, which I do in my underpants, is actually, I don't have any tomatoes anymore. The deer have eaten all mine. And then you've got a mere 6 hours before the 2 p.m. frontier with mad dogs and Englishman territory, uninhabitable heat from which few return unscathed. And then the sensible place to be is indoors with the hatches battened down, asleep, or at least box set oblivious to the scorch outside. Partly because of the afternoon siesta, but also because the seductively cool Damodar Notch-scented nights are the best time of day, Campo dwellers tend not to retire to bed early in summer. Like water during this season, sleep, a precious commodity at the best of times, is in scarce supply. When it gets as hot as it's been lately, I take it personally and sulk. I'm swatting unsuccessfully at an annoying fly while contemplating the potential meltdown of my thermal core, a process of corporeal warming postponed only by erratic gusts from the clatter of a cheap fan in the hotbox of my southwest-facing bedroom, a receptacle of glorious late light in winter, now a sitting duck in the crosshairs of a tyrannically warming planet. Taken hostage by the purgatory hours of early evening, an interval that in genteel and temperate climes we used to call tea time, I bake like a chicken in a tandoori oven, the puddling sweat between the back of my head and the pillow, a sign that my cooked body, so internally saturated by heat, is now radiating it in excess of the external temperature, which reads 41 degrees. I've become a radiator, and that cannot be good for you. Air conditioning. Assuming I'm still in Andalusia, this is the last summer I will deprive myself of this key to sanity. The ferocious sun, meanwhile, has propagated an algae in my swimming pool, which is now the colour of pea soup. As the long journey of August entrapment wears on, I distract myself with a form of wishful thinking, cultivating a welling excitement that was once a feature of my childhood. Then we called it the end-of-term feeling. It was an emotion that germinated and grew with the dawning realization that the school term was not interminable and that we were on the home straight and a finish line was tangibly within reach, the other side of which, albeit in a different guise, beckons me now. In place of being let out of school, I sense a release from summer, a partial rebirth into a cooler world not locked down by sun, where it is possible to feel human at tea time. As perceptible as the decadence that foretells the decline of an oppressive empire, could it be that this totalitarian season is beginning to lose its grip? Perhaps I'm calling this too early. It's only the 15th of August, after all. My mobile phone glows hot in my pocket still. There's no chocolate in Natura, the health food store. Ivana tells me that she's suspended orders to restock until late September because the chocolate melts in the van on the way from Germany. Another in need of air conditioning. There's still the backwash of insomniac nights which curdle in stale sweat to the beat of drum and bass from an all-night ferrier, and usher fatigued dawns that rasp your eyeballs like sandpaper. There's still no shade to park your car, shopping and panting dog. There's still time for blitzkriegs of heatwave and wildfire. Still time for another of those hideous days of klima when breathless parasite humidity drains blue from the sky, suffusing it in a grey rinse of something like methane. But when this airless Tupperware clears, it's not overly rose-tinted to suggest that the light has changed. The shadows are longer. The sun, a little lower in the sky, floats a more modest trajectory than the blatting halogen high of June, the then virile youth of summer, an unruly young wine, which, as we round the bend of August, hints now at maturity. Not yet the crianza of autumn, nothing so mellow, but these days are shorter, their hostile exposure less prolonged. Not quite twilight, but we've arrived at the late afternoon of a gradually tapering season. On the Rio Henao, where I used to live, for the campesino called Juan Máquina, the date August the 17th had special significance. In drier years, as we watched the river on which we depended recede to a trickle, interspersed with residual pools of trapped, heron-pecked fish, Juan would reassure us that as long as there was still a flow of some kind on that day, the 17th of August, our water was safe for another year, because by then the nights are longer, there's less evaporation, and the water table is no longer sinking. Gracias a Dios. We've done peak summer, mid-August. Early September is its dog end. There will be bumps in the road, but it's gently downhill from now on. But if it's all too much, you can always opt for air-cooled clothes. Yes, air-cooled clothes is a hot new fashion. In a world of soaring temperatures, wearable tech to combat the heat is improving all the time and is now making its way onto the fashion runways of Paris. Emily Chan writes that when Rick Owens presented, he's a designer, a series of air-conditioned jackets and tracksuit bottoms in collaboration with Adidas back in June, in the midst of a record-breaking 40-degree heat wave during Paris Men's Fashion Week, a fair few sweaty showgoers wished that they could slip into the cooling devices right away. The eye-catching inflatable garments contained built-in fans, which were used in conjunction with Adidas ClimaCool technology and ice vests to create a personal air conditioning system with the goal of cooling a runner's torso as much as possible before a race starts. But how far can air-conditioned clothing go in helping wearers deal with soaring temperatures? Fan jackets are by no means a new phenomenon. Former Sony engineer Hiroshi Ichigaya came up with the idea in the early 2000s after becoming concerned by the environmental impact of installing air conditioning units in all the skyscrapers being erected in Southeast Asia. Instead, his invention, a jacket featuring a fan on either side of the back, offered a low-energy, portable alternative. In 2004, Ichigaya brought his creation to the Japanese market via his company, Kuchifuku, literally translating to air-conditioned clothing, beginning with just one style. Demand grew alongside rising temperatures. During a sweltering heatwave in 2011, Ichigaya told ABC News that sales had increased tenfold. Fast forward to today, and fan jackets are a ubiquitous sight across Japan during these summer months, seen on construction workers, delivery drivers, and postmen alike. Prices start at around £90, that's 100 euros or 20,000 yen for a Kuchifuku version, while other popular brands include Bertel and Makita. They're just everywhere, Tokyo-based fashion writer Ashley Ogawa Clark says. The jackets are surprisingly effective. It's like having a portable fan inside your clothes all the time.
En Camino with Kid Hogg.
Declared him independence by the wonderful Donna Summer, of course. Now, Prat Airport in Barcelona is one of my favourites. The interior scheme of glass and bathroom green gives onto the broad vistas of airliners standing and landing on the seemingly limitless prairie of aerodrome that joins metropolis, mountain and sea. The black obsidian terminal floor shines like a shallow at low tide, over which you plash past fancy fooderies and fashion franchises to freedom, where an always waiting bus will whisk you down the Gran Via to Plaza Catalunya, the centre of town. I've been coming here for some years, but have never shared the place with quite as many humans as I did last week. One of Europe's most densely populated cities anyway, the cheek by jowl intensity of August is a choiceless proximity to other people that might be Calcutta. The procession of tourists clutter the usual airy sense of space at the airport. The metro is not far short of a Tokyo rush hour. The beach is an oiled seal colony of thongs and tattoos that you step over to access the less than pristine Med. The sidewalks echo to the trundle of plastic-wheeled suitcases, whilst Las Ramblas, the iconic boulevard that links Plaza Catalunya with the sea, digests its pedestrian overload with laboured metabolism. Tourist invasion notwithstanding, coming from a greying pueblo of stave-bearing campesinos sitting on benches and retired expatriates on their way to bridge and book club, it's impossible to remain less than stimulated by Barcelona's body culture. The city has a demographic dynamized by the young, gym-fit girls with attitude in short shorts, muscled young men in singlets. In the heavy humidity of a subtropical weather and in the absence of the wobbling obesity of those that gorge on processed sausage and sugary drinks, the required summer passion for scant clothing only emphasizes self-conscious, lithe, sexy youth. With Barcelona at bursting point in August, short-notice accommodation is something of a compromise. We found a bleakly furnished Airbnb on the planta principal of a Baroque terrace house in the teeming barrio of Poble Sec. Surgically clean, hard-edged, so impersonal it was that one enters with a QR code and leaves two nights later, having met no one. Our kitchen gave on to a series of backyards, brave attempts at gardening among detritus thrown from windows, and the small hours echo with alcohol-loud revelers in the stairwell. The flat was in marked contrast to the womb-like embrace of the fertility clinic that I was frequenting with a friend the next day. Here, in the fertility clinic, there were soft furnishings in hues of hushed mushroom and lemony yellows, scented candles and low lights illuminating bookshelves, paintings and fecund flower arrangements. A sweet and softly spoken receptionist, deep pile carpet, air conditioning and the pervasive smell of lavender made the soporific waiting room an irresistible prospect for a siesta. After all, napping is requisite recovery in a place where, inevitably, you find yourself on your feet, walking for hours from street to street, barrio to barrio, kilometres of urban trekking, the best way to see a city. And in pursuance of our visit to the fertility clinic, we now had an agenda that was anything but capricious sightseeing. The day's challenge was clear: to obtain 70 shots of progesterone, because here in Spain, this essential accompaniment to in vitro fertilization is half the price that it is in Britain, to where my friend was returning next day. And so it was that through the gorgeous inner sanctums of Born and Gotico, where the natural tendency is to float from art gallery to restaurant to designer boutique, we chemist hopped. And this was okay. Whilst lacking the soft furnishing of the fertility clinic, pharmacies are unfailingly air-conditioned, and there was usually at least one chair that I could occupy whilst surreptitiously magnetised by the poised grace of the staff, white-coated young women with pearl fingernails, nose stud, a pinprick gem in an aquiline nostril, inscrutable, unobtainable, exuding the fascination of a life form with which I have very little in common. Having added to our progesterone portfolio, we'd move on to the next green neon sign. There were lots of chemists in Barcelona. At night, when the narrow streets of Poble-Sec are laced with tables laden with mojitos and negronis, the dogs come out to paseo in surprising numbers. To care for a dog in a place so ostensibly designed for humans is not an obvious thing to do. The city dog is typically plodding through an existence tethered to repetition, anaesthetized by routine-induced ennui, attached to his owner by a harness from which dangles a plastic capsule full of poo bags. In every sense, dog and owner are just going through the motions. On our last night, the steak I ordered was inedible for a man with few teeth. In a bid to lighten the tedium of his nightly routine, I fed it to a mutt, patiently waiting his owner outside the supermarket. And that's my postcard from Barcelona. It's time for this. Yes, a very first world row is brewing in the leafy suburbs of Richmond and Hampstead, where not only humans are prone to obesity, owners of cats are becoming increasingly displeased with their weight gain on this week's Things That Grow. On this week's Things That Grow, the part of the show called Things That Grow, London's fat cats are everywhere, apparently, inducing angst among their owners. This contrasts with my pueblo here in Spain, where cats are skeletal, feral, and colonize rubbish tips. There are feline devotees that feed them in my village. My friend Jose Maria potters daily to the recycling bins, where the cats scavenge in the bins with a bag. He carries a bag of dry feed. My octogenarian neighbour has at least eight previous strays that are now in his garden and defecate and spray there liberally. The sickly sweet smell of cat poo wafts gaggingly over the gardens, over the garden wall. It's a deeply unwholesome scent, cat poo, a synthesis of fragrances that just don't belong together, like the inappropriate combination of deodorant sprayed onto an unwashed armpit. That's what it reminds me of anyway. Another character in the Pueblo interplay between human and feline is the steriliser, Marsha. She's a scary Dutch woman who catches stray cats and summarily delivers them to the vet for neutering. I think they see her coming. No, if you're ever reincarnated as a cat, avoid Andalusia. London is the place to be, and this is from where Emma Jacobs writes. She says, I recently stopped outside my flat to stroke Dorothy, my friend's tortoiseshell cat, who was basking in the low evening sun. This was a moment, I thought smugly, of harmonious communion with my cat. Though suddenly she shot off and darted down the road, hurtling towards a woman I'd never seen before. Are you after cookies, Dorothy? She cooed as Dorothy curled around her legs. And then she explained to me that she usually brings Dorothy a snack. God, not another one. Despite being asked to refrain from leaving food on our wall, some neighbours persist with treats, tuna or cat food. One woman remonstrated to my partner, "It's just a bit of chicken," as if a hunk of meat doesn't count. Dorothy's weight is a constant topic of family discussion. Apologies if she's reading this, she's that intelligent. Spending the first 2 years of her life as a stray on a garage roof, she knows a thing or two about charming passers-by and slips into neighbours' homes, helping herself to their pets' dinners. Nervous about fat shaming, I've nonetheless posted on Nextdoor, which is a sort of chat group, I guess, to request that neighbours stop feeding her. And nor am I alone. Rogue feeders are a common topic of discussion and source of tension on the platform. One respondent even suggested a woman should call the police when she complained of a young girl making her cat sick with constant treats of tuna in oil. The platform Nextdoor says that in the past year, 1.7 million posts across the world mention cats, with more than 40,000 about feeding cats, typically with a subject header, "Is anyone else feeding this cat?" Within the UK, Northern Ireland apparently takes the crown for most cat-related posts. In the past 12 months, neighbours in the US and UK posted about cats more than 1.72 million times, and with the US a touch more preoccupied than UK owners about feeding habits. Elsewhere, Facebook groups are devoted to lost and stolen pets. One woman writes of her six-dinner Sid. Six-dinner Sid is the character in Inga Moore's 1990 children's book, who makes himself at home in six different houses on the street, including eating six dinners. So he got fed six times a day. He just go from one street, one house to another. Since no one talked to their neighbours in Aristotle Street, no one knew what Sid was up to. He had six different names to remember and six different ways to behave. He only got busted when he got sick and went to the vet six times. Rogue feeders, they're often staunch deniers. A friend approached a woman as she suspected of feeding her cat, as the cat was beginning to take on a perfumed smell. When the neighbour opened the door, the scent was overwhelming, but she steadfastly refused to admit that the pet was a house guest. Maggie's teenage daughter went to the home of a woman to request she stop feeding their family's ultra-fluffy Maine Coon Ragdoll cross. She also denied it. "But there was a wall of cat food. She doesn't have a cat," said Maggie. They also refer to their cat as six-dinner Sid, as he's prone to bouts of wandering. "He's always in other people's houses," says Maggie, who prefers not to use her real name. "We got a collar that says, 'Don't feed me,' and he took it off. We bought seven types of food to mix it up. He's getting spoiled rotten at home, but he's curious and friendly. Other neighbours have kept their doors closed in the stifling heat wave to stop him entering, including the one who found him nuzzling in her bed one morning. Maggie hopes the cat, who is only 7 months old, will settle in soon and curb his promiscuity. She also hopes that he will begin to lose a little bit of weight, because he is another of this very first world problem of fat cats. And on that note, it's time for me to leave you. Have a wonderful weekend. My thanks to Giles Brown for the second installment of Hannibal. We'll be having more of that later in probably late September or October, so hang on for that. In the meantime, have a great weekend, and we look forward to seeing you next week. Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.